I have to make a confession. Probably like sending a blind guy to read a book on painting. I don't drink. So,
oh, that's okay.
So this is. So I am one of those iced tea drinkers that you so despise at restaurants.
Oh darn! I knew it. That would come back to haunt me.
It's bitten you in the butt. Yes.
Well, we'll on the reprint we will revise that. But
I thought that was funny though. But yeah. So be gentle with me if I seem totally out to lunch, because I'm totally out to lunch on this.
Oh, that's all right.
How did you? Because your family were not wine drinkers.
No, they were
good Scots
they
stock,
were.
Which was yep. any kind of alcohol.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Just as long as it's distilled. Beer and whiskey people, that's what was on the table. And certainly not so much with dinner, but, you know, just the rollicking Kayleys at night. And so I didn't come to wine until I was in my mid-20s. And, I like to say I started drinking when I met my husband, and he's okay with that because there is some upside in being married to a wine writer. But he did introduce me to wine, and in a number of ways. When we went out to restaurants after we graduated from school and had a bit more money, we started ordering a nice bottle of wine with dinner. But also we were casting around trying to think of what night course could we take together just for fun. And we tried pottery, and we tried Spanish, and we tried golf, but that was no good because we were both type A personalities. Easy access to long iron clubs. No. So we thought, and then I saw a wine course and I thought, we can drink at night. Yeah, we can do that. So we set up at a local college, registered, and had so much fun taking this wine, basic wine appreciation.
You had a lot more fun than he did because you kept going and became a...
I did, yeah.
You're now a full-fledged sommelier? Is that
yes, sommelier, yes, or sommelier, yeah. Wine gal. It's all getting a lot more casual these days. There's the wine dude and the wine gal. And
wine wench, though, apparently.
Yeah, no, that hasn't come into vogue or already passed. But no, I continued with the four-level certificate program at night. I had a day job in a high-tech computer company. But I was fascinated by wine, and I wanted to finish this course just for my personal satisfaction in being more confident about it. And I just was drawn to it. There's so much to it. To me, it's like a full five senses experience. You can talk about it, you can learn about it, but there's just the fun of drinking too, which I always come back to. That's why it's in the title.
Yeah, when I first looked at it, I'd actually written the title down in my book, Red, White, and Drunk All Over, and then I went back to it a little while later, and I went, I can't really, because I have terrible handwriting, I can't really read my handwriting, but it looks like it's something called Red, White, and Drunk All Over, but that can't be.
That can't be it.
Surprise.
No. Yeah, exactly. It's supposed to, in polite circles, have the meaning that I was drinking in many regions, wine regions. But as you've probably discovered, I do like to drink. And so I think that, too, that it's good to acknowledge that wine actually has alcohol in it, and that, you know, there's a reason we don't have orange juice critics. We're drawn to the buzz as much as I think the hedonism and the sensory pleasure and the rose petals and the arcs of tar and whatever else you're getting out of your glass. I think there's a real draw to it because it has so many facets, including the booze.
You know, these days, a good CD and an okay bottle of wine, well, an okay CD and an okay bottle of wine these days, cost about the same amount.
Yes.
Yet you go into the record store and no one goes, this is the area, this is the recording studio this was done in, the backup musicians of this, there's a little hint of cherry in the oboe playing.
Right.
Nobody does that. But with a
right.
bottle of wine, you get all this and fuss about it. Like, you're spending $20. It's 20, you know,
it's
or 30. But so on the high end, I can understand it. But
yes.
But people spend an awful lot of time thinking about this.
They do. And that can be a good thing or a bad thing. It's a bad thing if it keeps people away from wine, intimidated by it, or it's just too fussy for what should be a simple purchase, especially at $10-$20 or whatever. You just want a glass, you know, a good glass of wine with dinner. It's a good thing for those who are looking for more information and are fascinated by the subject and want to dig deeper and all that sort of thing. But it's really very much double-edged, two-edged sword.
Yeah, one of the reasons people talk about wine is because people talk about wine. and it sort of perpetuates itself.
It does.
And you talk about two critics who have sort of different philosophies. Yeah. Robert
Parker and Jancis Robinson. Yeah, they got into quite a feud, actually, a transatlantic feud. Robert Parker is based in Maryland, Baltimore, in the States, and Jancis Robinson is from London, England. And what was interesting about the debate, it was over one bottle of wine from Bordeaux, which Jancis rated 12 out of 20, and other critics said you need a brain and a palate transplant to like this wine. Meanwhile, Robert Parker said it was made by perfectionists and rated it 96 to 100 out of 100.
And he's got a lot of pull.
They say in the business, a wine he rates 80 or under can't be sold because people think it's inferior. A wine rated 90 or above can't be bought because it sells out too quickly. There's too much demand. He moves the wine market. He's very powerful. Jancis has more of a following over in Europe and Britain, is more of a writer, whereas Parker is the critic. And so this debate really crystallized the difference in roles, their roles, writer versus critic, but also the difference in palates, what the old world European Brits like, what we like over here in North America, and also the fundamental difference of what should wine be. Should wine come from the soil, the place it's made, or should it sprout up from a marketing plan with a slick label and be consistent in the way some fast food joints are?
And from the looks of things, you come down your own little thing.
Yes.
Page 217.
Oh, very good.
First and foremost, drink what you like. Think of wine like clothing. Most of us choose it based on comfort, not fashion.
Yes, absolutely. Drink what you like. I mean, I think the information's there, the critics are there if you want that kind of guidance. But in the end, it's a drink, and it's about taste, and it's about enjoyment, and you really should follow your own palate. There's no replacement for that, and it's not cool to just follow what Parker rates 90 and above all the time. You really have to enjoy it. It's a very personal thing, wine, just like the food you eat.
One of my favorite films last couple of years, Sideways.
Yes.
And anyone says Merlot now, and I just automatically say, I'm not drinking any fucking Merlot!
Yeah.
It just pops out of my mouth. There's a Paul Giamatti's character just spouts that.
Yes.
He's a Pinot Noir nut.
Yes.
In Sideways. And you spend a fair amount of time talking about Pinot, but at one point you say, well, you know, a good Pinot does taste like a barnyard.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a good thing, believe it or not.
Okay, this is why I guess I'm not so much a wine drinker, because okay. I can't. Now get me around to understanding
okay.
why that's a good thing.
Let me rephrase barnyard. Freshly turned earth, does that help? Maybe not.
Still, I'm not so much with the pycophilia, eating dirt, so again, keep working.
Okay, there are other flavors and aromas going on with the dirt. It's not just a glass of dirt. So you've got your mushrooms and your truffles and your burning fall leaves and all those other sorts of things, which it's okay if you can't pick them out. But there's something, I think of a truffle dish. The mushroomy truffle, not the chocolate truffle, but with the shavings of truffle over it. There's something sensual and earthy about an exotic or something that draws you in, if you like truffles, of course. And that's going on in a glass of Pinot Noir as well. And I think that's why a lot of people are actually fanatic about Pinot Noir, if they're going to be fanatics about wine. There's something alluring and very... yeah, sensual. It's really hard to describe, and maybe that's part of the allure to words fail as they are right now. but don't worry about the barnyard stuff. It's all part of the mix. You're looking at me very doubtfully.
I'm the man who drinks iced tea and chocolate milk, so okay. I'm just putting this Philistine sign on my head, and you're fine. The language of wine
yes.
is something that... I find fairly funny. What was it? Something about Neve Campbell. This
yes.
tastes like Neve Campbell wearing latex.
In latex, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like
I know. Yeah, I don't think
and
that's
I like
good.
Neve Campbell, but...
Yeah, and have you ever sniffed her in latex? That's the other thing. It's just not relevant to our life experience if you start talking about wine like that.
On the other hand, I kind of understood what that would be like.
Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah.
Good imagination.
Yeah. I guess
trouble
so.
Trouble with the barnyard.
But
okay. 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 There's a lot of schools of wine writing out there, and that the one you're alluding to is part of Wine X, which was originally aimed at Gen X, although all the Gen Xers are getting middle-aged themselves. But it was talking about wine in a funky way with pop cultural references and hoping by doing that to make it more accessible and fun and that sort of thing. I think wine language has to hit somewhere in the middle in terms of being practical and having that element of fun. And getting away from the pretension and the snobbery, but people have to be able to relate to what you're saying. So I try to avoid the fruit salad school of wine writing. And so you talk about plums and blackberries and cherries and, you know, a long list of fruit, which I'd be fooling myself to think I could get that all that out of one wine. So I usually stick to one fruit if I'm going to mention it, or just dark fruit, light fruit, whatever. So that people at least have some idea. This is a big wine. It's a full-bodied wine with dark fruit. It'll go well with your steak.
I learned an awful lot about wine that I hadn't ever learned before, and I've done different books on wine, and okay. I didn't realize that I thought it was like French wine, and then someone said, no, there are all these regions in France. You have to understand the region. And I thought that was okay. And then I started to read your book, and it's like, it's not just the region, it's the sub-region. Yeah. And I thought, it's not just that, it's actually the winery. And it's just not that, it's actually the vineyard itself. But no, Natalie McLean has to take me, it's some of the grapes on the slope, at a certain spot, they're the ones that taste good. And that was when I went, I will never, ever be smart enough to figure this out.
Right.
How can some grapes on one vineyard taste better than others?
Because of differences in their exposure to sunshine and drainage. Vines are plant, of course, and they will react and produce differently flavored fruit depending on how much water they get, what their exposure is to the sun. So when you talk about a slope, it's actually pretty straightforward. The vines at the top of the slope don't get enough water. The vines in the middle of the slope are just right, like Mama Bear's chair or something. And then the ones at the bottom of the slope are soaking. Their roots are wet. And so they're going to produce grapes that are bloated with water. So that's why it may sound fussy, but makes sense that the vines that grow in the middle of the slope are experiencing ideal conditions.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Another one of my observations, a lot of women in this book, which I thought was great. Huh. Because I thought of wine like every industry, and especially snobby industries, tend to be full of boring white guys.
Well, there are still quite a few boring white guys.
Oh, good, because I'm one myself, and I really was worried of going out of fashion.
No worries there. If you look at the champagne houses, they were all run by young women. It's a good point. Some of the writers are now women. They say, although it's not been proven definitively, that women may have better palates, either because of evolution, because they were the cookers in the family and the people that tasted the berries to see if they were medicinal or going to kill the kids. So there's a lot of reasons why women are getting into the business. What surprised me when I was writing this book is that I came across the statistic from the New York Times, actually, that women buy 77% of wine, which makes sense because they're often the household purchasers of all goods, groceries, but they drink 60% of wine. Yeah, that surprised me. I didn't realize that women were consuming so much wine. And I think that's why we're seeing a lot of wines now targeted at women. So there's the low-cal wines, there's a wine called White Little Lie, and on the cork it says, this isn't new, I bought this last year, like the clothing or whatever, hiding the shopping bags. And so those are wines sprung from a marketing plan, but it also speaks to the fact that marketers, wine companies are recognizing that women are buying a lot of the wine and very much part of the industry now too.
Some really wackos. I was going to say something polite like eccentrics, but there's some wacky people in this book.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what makes some of them.
That's what makes the business so interesting, is that, you know, wine inspires passion, charisma, and outright wackiness.
These are not accountants or actuaries. Definitely not.
No, they're not. They're people who are finding their own way in the world and expressing their individuality through wine. down in California, Randall Graham, with Bonnie Doon Vineyards. And he's been dubbed the Rhone Ranger because he plants Rhone grapes. But he also makes appearances dressed as the Rhone Ranger, and he's landed a spacecraft in the middle of his vineyards, which was a made-over golf cart, and he's done some really strange things. Oh, he hosted a funeral for Cork, you know, the closure for wine, in Grand Central Station in New York. So they actually marched an open casket full of cork through Grand Central Station. The reason they were doing this is they're trying to advocate that everyone switch over to screw caps, which don't damage wine as much. You get cork taint if you use cork sometimes. So he does very dramatic things. He's into the biodynamics in terms of
viticulture. He does some crazy things with wine, like yes. Trying things that other people go, well, you yes. can't do that.
Right.
And he goes, well, why not?
Why not? Yes. Like he didn't think his wines had enough minerality, which is very hard to identify in wine, but so he just threw some rocks into the fermenting vat and to see if the rocks would give it the wine more minerality, but he had to put a stop to that when the federal authorities said there could be some toxic elements like lead or arsenic leaching off the stone. So that's not a good thing. But he's open to experimentation, and through all his marketing tricks and also winemaking innovation, I think he's opening our eyes to what wine can be and how we think about it. And I think he is leading the way. It's not all silliness or total wackiness. There is a direction behind what he does, and he's trying to make wine more accessible, but also better tasting.
Now, one of the strange things I found in the book is a guy who sells wine glasses, but not just ordinary wine glasses. And he actually did an experiment that I think you participated in. Tell me about
yes.
that one.
George Riedel is the 10th generation of the Riedel family from Austria to make specially designed glasses for wine. In fact, he makes 90 different types of glasses just for wine. And so now we switch from wine snobbery to glass snobbery. But it actually makes a difference what you put your wine into. So we did some experiments, if you will, with really those small itsy bitsy golf ball glasses that you often get in restaurants, which are just really horrible for wine, and the wine glasses he had designed. Wine is volatile, meaning the aromas go up in the air if you can swirl them. First of all, you can't swirl them in the itsy bitsy golf ball glasses because it'll end up on your shirt. But there's not enough room for the wine to move around, and therefore for the aromas to come up. It actually did make a difference. I thought it wouldn't. I'm really against anything that smacks of marketing, and I didn't want to believe, but he convinced me.
Reading the book, it's a good read.
Thank you.
There's a lot of sex in this book. I don't know how else to put it, but
sensuality,
I think, man, that's another sex reference. I thought, maybe it's just me. So I went, took a cold shower, came back to the book. It's like, no, there's a lot of sex in this book. So I need to know about this one.
I'm bolder on the page than I am in person. I think wine is very sexual, if you will. It touches all the senses. And another hang-up, perhaps, along with the one, you know, don't talk about wine as though it has alcohol, don't talk about wine as though it excites and moves you, and that you can use description that is very sensual or sexual to describe what it is you're feeling. And that's what it does for me.
Okay, that's what I hoped it was.
Okay.
Because otherwise, I feel like I'm going to need a lot more cold showers. This is how I pick a wine.
Ah.
And I go in and look at the labels. And I thought I was silly until there's a section of the book about labels. So I felt much better.
Oh, good.
This is my system. I go in and never buy a wine that has a mammal on the label.
Yeah, or a marsupial. Yeah.
Or a marsupial. Yeah, marsupials, I'm not so
bit
sure.
But okay.
I haven't decided on that one. I should figure that out. Duckbill platypus wine? Birds, insects, all good. Nothing cartoon, though.
Right. Fluffy squirrels out.
Yeah, if they got big, goofy eyes. If it's an actual squirrel, you know, nicely rendered, I would go with that.
Yeah.
Architecture good, unless it's like really pretentious. Like if Neuschwanstein is on the kids, it's like, nah. But it's a nice, tasteful building. Yeah, and that's
it.
Basically how That's how I do it. And I thought I was really stupid, but apparently no.
No, that's how most people decide on which wine they're going to drink, because there's, you really, you know, legally can't open up the wine and try it in the store to decide whether you like it. So this is a sealed package, and all you've got is the label, and unless you're buying the same wine over and over and over again, one wine, and people get into that rut too. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but there's so much to experience. That's all they have to go on. So that's why I think wine critics or writers have more influence in this category than, say, they might for cabbage or orange juice or whatever, because it's really hard to pick a bottle of wine. Although you can narrow it down with some tips. You know, you can look at the alcohol level, like on the front. If it's 12 to 14%, you know that's a really big whopping wine. And if that's the style you like, great. So you can start to look for things like that. If it's low alcohol, that's what you want. You can look at the back label for what kind of description there is that might help you. If you see toasty, vanilla, oaky, you know it's been oaked. If you see citrus fruit, oranges, lemons, limes, you know it's going to be zesty with some acidity. It's going to go well with pasta or whatever. So
The old this only whites only go with this, reds only go with that. That is
that's gone? Out. Yes.
Pretty much.
Yeah. There are some things that will clash, but there really doesn't need to be so many rules when it comes to wine and food matching. People get hung up that they're making a mistake, that they'll be wrong. There's a lot about wine where they're just afraid they'll be wrong. They pick the wrong bottle, wrong food and wine match, and it's really the fear of looking stupid or having a bad taste experience. You get the bottle home and you feel stupid because you made a bad decision. But really, many wines today are being made so that they are pretty generous in that they're drinking early. They don't have to be aged forever. 99% of wines really are made to be consumed within, you know, a year or two of when they're bought. You can drink them right away. And that also means they're going to match up with food much better. They're not harsh. They're not really acidic, really tannic, those elements that can really grate in your mouth and with food. So you can't make too many mistakes when it comes to matching food and wine.
Is when you go out to a restaurant and they shove the wine list in front of you, I've got an easy out. It's like, I don't drink. Next.
Yes.
And hand it over to somebody else. But if you're the person who's suddenly, you know, first of all, the price range is like, yes. I mean, you could go bankrupt just by picking the wrong wine.
Yes.
But also, if it doesn't work with the meal, it's your fault.
I know. You're responsible for people's happiness. Hate that.
It's pressure.
Well, I think, you know, you can try asking for the help of the wine guy or wine gal.
I don't trust them, though, because all I can think of is, like, they're just like, $150 bottle, and I get 10% or something.
Right.
But I shouldn't worry about that.
No, because actually most sommeliers or bartenders, wine guys and gals are actually on salary if they've got a fairly established program. They're not on the tips. But also they want you to come back again. Most wine people, wine staff that I've run into are not out to sell you the Venus Porsche. So I think you can help them out by narrowing your question. You can say, listen, I like full-bodied reds. What have you got on your list that you're really excited about? Just point them in a direction. Or, you can have the list in front of you and you can be pointing to the prices. Anything in this range with full body? So you don't want to declare out loud how much you're willing to pay for your date or whatever, declare for love or your business deal. So they can help you narrow it down. But I think a lot of people just don't know where to start, don't know what to ask. But just asking the person who created the list, what are you really excited about? And if you can add a few more factors that narrow it down in full-bodied reds or in a refreshing white, can you talk to me about what you're really keen on in this list? That helps.
Somebody listening right now, I'm about to make a wine purchase, and they're in a rut. My dad, he was into Spätlesers for way too long. I would have liked him to try something else.
Sure.
So someone ready to experiment, try something new, what things should they look at as they're looking at that sea of countries, I guess, because it's mostly by country now.
Right. Well, they can, it depends on what you like and if you want to make a jump that's close. So your dad with his Spätlese from Germany, a little bit of an off-dry white, might like to try something close, like a Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand. And again, you can want a lot of the staff in wine stores these days are very knowledgeable. So that would be a great way for your dad to start. I like this. What else have you got? I don't want another German Riesling. Can you recommend something that's, I still want a white wine, zippy, I like, because he obviously likes the acidity, that wine. So you can try something close, but there's a lot of wine regions. If you just want to experiment, one of the best ways to do it is buy a mixed case of 12 different wines in your price range, and then you can find a new favorite. So that's what I often advise friends to do. So buy 12 different wines, all in $10 to $15 range. It's not a big commitment. You don't feel silly, and you've got to find probably one or two in there that you'll like. But there's a lot of wine regions these days that are producing excellent value wines too, like Niagara and Okanagan. We produce some great wines here at great prices. But also Chile, Australia, South Africa, New Zealand. There's some really, really well-made wines at good prices.
Apparently, from what you say, this is like the best wine, like we are in the best, usually there's the golden age, yes. But this is the golden age. Wine has never been better. The bad stuff is mostly gone.
Yes.
The good stuff, even, you know, the medium stuff, the lower end stuff is better than...
Yeah, it is. Because winemaking technology has improved. So for your really cheap wines, you've got better technology applied to them, so they're not so harsh anymore. You've got France, who always had a lock hold on the market, waking up because they're having their lunch eaten by the Australians. The Australians took over in the UK and in America, and I think even here in Canada, they may be number one now over the French in terms of total sales. So what's happened with these old world countries like France and Italy and Spain is they are starting to pay attention to, okay, we can't send an unripe wine out to the market. Some still try, but more and more, the wines are better made, better priced, and they're starting to market them better too, in a more friendly way. You know, that when you have a label, maybe putting the grapes on would help, that it's not your, you know, an inadequacy of your own education that you don't know what's in a Bordeaux, the five red grapes, you know. So they're starting to realize that people want more information, and slowly they're doing that.
It's almost noon. If we were going to go out and grab a glass of wine, what would you feel like right now?
Because it's midday and I delude myself into thinking white wines are somehow lighter, I would go with a New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc. But also a lot of lunch dishes are salads or fish or whatever, so it's a great wine for those kind of dishes.
The book is Red, White, and Drunk All Over, A Wine-Soaked Journey from Grape to Glass. I've been speaking with the author, Natalie McLean, and you can go to nataliemclean.com, and you've got a great newsletter that's like free?
Yes, I've got a free e-newsletter, and I send out my wine picks and tips and that sort of thing, and there's lots of information about the book there too.
And Red, White, and Drunk All Over is published by Doubleday Canada.